Driven by these various drives within us, is it at all possible to realize the spiritual life? All the great teachers of the world emphasized above all purity and simple morality. If these drives are in us, operating all the time, there can be no yoga in the whole sense, howsoever much we may practice the physical aspect of yoga in terms of the postures and the breathing. But if we practice the physical aspect and do not at the same time realize the psychological aspect of it within ourselves, then that physical aspect produces profounder conflict in our own being. It has to be borne in mind. Haven't you noticed? One may go to a concert and be wonderfully uplifted, or to a church or temple or wherever it is, experience a sublime mood, and then we come back to ordinary life, as we say, out of the concert hall, out of the temple, and the first little stimulus which annoys us calls forth a much more intense reaction of anger or hate from us than under ordinary circumstances. Because, you see, the spiritual, the pure, the wonderful intensifies every aspect of ourself, both the good and the bad. This must be very clearly borne in mind. And most people don't. They think in terms of compensation, in terms of overcoming evil. You cannot overcome evil. Never. You can only transform it. And you cannot transform it by willing to transform it, by a determined activity directed against it, because that is the state of conflict. There is only one extraordinary transmuting alchemy which resides in the living human being. And that is the power of such dispassionate attention that understanding emerges. Not merely intellectual understanding, that is all kindergarten work, but this profound understanding which is completely wedded to transcendent love. And that is the magical thing that heals, that makes whole and perfect. So you see, non-covetousness is not very easy with all the drives of ambition and consequent jealousy, envy, and so forth attached to it. The next one, continence. The Sanskrit word is brahmacharya. Brahmacharya. It's usually translated as sexual abstinence. It is a great pity that merely that aspect is emphasized. Brahmacharya literally means walking in Brahma, in Brahma, not only to Brahma. Brahma, use if you like the ordinary English term, God. A walking in God. You will find all the great mystics of all the religions using that phrase. Sufi mystics, Christian mystics, Hindu mystics, they have all used that term, a walking in God, Brahmacharya. Now, Brahmacharya practically implies, therefore, in our everyday life, freedom from all self-indulgence, from all sense indulgence. Now please note, sense indulgence. The nature of the world is such that inevitably pleasure and pain will come to us. If I fall down on the street whilst I'm walking, well, it'll hurt, of course. If there is a beautiful sunset, it will give me pleasure, of course. Whatsoever pain, pleasure, and the corresponding joy, sorrow, psychological correspondence of joy and sorrow accompanies it, naturally must be attended to, noted, attended, be sensitive to it. Very, very sensitive to it. But be neither attached to it, either the pleasure or the pain, nor give way to aversion from it. Now this is something, I believe, quite different from what has been conventionally handed down to us through the millennia on this matter. Freedom from sense indulgence, therefore. You don't go out to acquire pleasure. You don't deliberately seek to avoid pain. This is very difficult. Rather an austere doctrine. But keep wide awake and see what happens in everyday life. If you will not deliberately try to avoid pain, be sensible about it. Don't do anything or deliberately walk into pain. The masochistic type does that. Now, continence, understood in that way, brings about the fulfillment of another meaning of continence. One is self-contained. And to be self-contained does not mean to be aloof from people, from situations, from things, from relationships. To be self-contained means not to be an obtrusion upon the situation. Notice how everyone hugs his so-called personality to himself. His personality is largely the false image in his own mind of what he is. He says, this is what I am, this is my personality, this is my image which I have to sustain in the world. Image. Something dead. Something which is not the real living being. a shadow. So, if you are self-contained, then you do not thrust this personality upon the outside world. You do not hold fast to this false image of yourself which you have in your mind. You just remain awake, observant, watchful. And in that quiet watchfulness, without indulging, without fighting against, in that quiet watchfulness, the awareness of what you really are emerges out of you. It's a living emergence, not a dead mechanical image which is built up. So much for continence. Kindliness. I like the word Ruth, because it's opposite. Ruthless, pitiless, is something which we know only too well in life. Look at the pitilessness of men the world over. As they work, as they strive, as they fight, as they destroy, as they struggle to attain their own desires and so forth. Watch it, watch it. Millions of us pride ourselves on belonging to the free peoples of the world. We are all slaves. Slaves to our ignorance, our greeds, our resentments, our ambitions, our self-isolation, slaves to the misery which we bring upon our own selves, and our intellect, or what we call the intellect, is continuously the slave of desire. It is a charming illusion which so many cherish, that, oh, we look at things dispassionately, objectively. Particularly if we have the scientific temperament. No less a world famous scientist than Eddington, in his Tanner lectures in Cambridge of 1936, pointed out quite clearly that the scientist suffers from a delusion there. No one can be totally free from subjectivity. Quite impossible. And why should one be? We are both subjective and objective. We must just recognize the fact. Do I have only a right hand and not a left hand? I have both. Subjectivity and objectivity, in their harmony and their balance, make for right perception. And they make for self-knowledge in the real and the profound sense. Not the knowledge which we merely gather through a process of analysis with certain norms, criteria, evaluations, judgments at the back of those norms. That is not self-knowledge. However, that we may deal with a little later on. I must go on. Abstemiousness in eating and drinking. You know, all yoga and all religious disciplines stress this very strongly. abstemiousness in eating. What is the origin of greed? My very first experience after I am born, my mother puts me to her breast soon after I am born, and I go on suckling away till I am sozzled. Then the second time, the third time I do that, perhaps the fourth time, my mother is not feeling up to it, so she rather prematurely, I think, pushes me away. What happens? I scream with rage. The first resentment, the first hate. It sounds very funny to us now. But have you the imaginative power to go back to that event, to those events? Work them out and see. Eating and drinking is the very foundation, the very root from which come out greed and resentment and hate. The sense of thou and I are separate and we are in conflict. Now, what is all our daily effort directed to when we are adults? We call it earning our living, which means that we are going to feed ourselves in order to continue the body, and secondarily, be able to carry out those relationships and activities which will perpetuate the race. And both are associated with intense pleasure. Out of our ignorance, we do not see that the pleasure drive in us, in actual fact, is not a pleasure drive only. It is a pleasure-pain drive. Look into it very carefully, very intelligently, constantly. And you will see, yes, all life, all drives which emphasize the self and bring what is pleasant to our particular selves, all of it is the source of sorrow. Whatsoever comes naturally, unsought, and after it has come, and you have been sensitively responding to it, you let it go completely, without desiring to hold it back, and above all, without desiring to repeat the experience, that is happiness. That's where happiness is utterly different from pleasure. And when that awareness emerges into full flower in us, and when we are in right relationship within our own being and with everyone and everything else, then whether the world and the immediate circumstance sends stimuli which are pleasant or painful, we are happy. So you see, in that happiness, there is nothing acquisitive, nothing which is fought against, nothing which is sought for oneself or for your group. Then there is real happiness. That is man's natural state. The state of conflict is the state of the sub-man, the sub-human. I, as I am, in the state of conflict, of confusion, the state which makes me want to grasp, to hold, the state of fear, of anxiety, I am a subhuman. The true human is free from all that. He is, to use the Christian term, the Son of Man. That's the real meaning of the Son of Man. And the Son of Man, remember, is identical with the Son of God. The two are no different. You'll find this in Hindu teachings, in yoga, everywhere you'll find this. So now, I think that is enough with regard to eating and drinking. Then, with regard to the different niyamas, I won't mention all of them. I'll just mention the principal ones. Austerity, which includes fasting. Do remember, fasting and starving are quite different. Starving is deprivation which has been forced upon you either by circumstance or by your own lack of good sense. That is starving. But fasting is relinquishing what is not essential. Now you work that out for yourself. To relinquish what is not essential. You have to decide for yourself what is essential. The next is contentment with what comes naturally. Supposing all the world over, the so-called developed countries and the so-called developing countries. Supposing their inheritance really understood contentment with what comes naturally without striving too much for it. Do you think that we would be plagued with the economic problems that we are all plagued with? That is purely on the physical side. Consider the psychological side. We want love, we want friendship, we want position, prestige, power, status symbols, as if we haven't got enough burden carrying our own little selves. Supposing we were content with what came to us naturally and wide awake to it, your entire life would be full of peace and happiness. These are just the preliminaries to yoga. Do remember. The next one, charity. I think everyone understands that. There's no need to expatiate on that. Except that in the old days in India, gifts to deserving persons was the sort of subtitle, if you like, of charity. Perhaps it was a way invented by the Brahmins and the Bhikkhus and so forth to ensure that they had their food at least every third day. Gifts to deserving persons. That is how it is put. And then there is another important one. Shame at contravening social and Vedic rules. put it in our modern terms, conscience. So those were the yamas and niyamas. And now we come back to this question. I know I have got common sense. Can you tell me how to get good sense? When one lives this sort of life, one becomes purified in thought and feeling. Our senses then are far keener. They operate far more efficiently than they ever did before. And the response to our sense functioning from the mind, from the brain if you like, is of a totally different nature from the response to our sense functioning by our minds as they are now. This is where the difference comes. And this is what I mean by the term good sense. It is the purified one who has good sense. I, the subhuman, may have any amount of common sense, which I use for the furtherance of my ambitions and greeds and desires and all the rest of it. See the difference? I'm just taking up a question which I answered or tried to answer last time. I enjoy the pleasures of all the senses. Not only that, I feel they bring me closer to the ultimate reality. I don't believe this is wrong. Why does yoga preach continence and abstinence from physical pleasures? I trust that this question has received some considerable answer in what has been said already. Just one point I may add to that. The indulgence in sense pleasures, and this includes indulgence in enjoying what we call cultural pursuits, music and science and art and philosophy and all the rest of it. This is intellectual and aesthetic indulgence. I don't mean, for goodness sake, don't think I mean don't go to concerts and all the rest of it. Far from it. Do go, yes. But be very watchful. Do not wallow in it. The indulgence in sense pleasures deadens profound inner sensitivities of the mind which are trying to emerge, if you will let them. This is something which the true religia, the true mystic, the true yogi is enabled to do. These profounder sensitivities of the mind. We don't know what we are. We think we do. We've only got hold of the husk. The kernel is something far deeper. So that is why yoga and religious disciplines warn the religia and the yogi and tell him to abstain from indulgence in sense pleasures. There is a question here. Can you please explain in more detail your statement about the negative approach having more and greater bearing than the positive? I think what has already been said would have conveyed a good deal. But the essential point here is just this, and I mentioned it last time too. We do not know the positive side. It is actually out of our ordinary experience. We think we do. For example, we say, surely we do know not only hate, but we know love. Do we? Yes, only insofar as this love-hate form the duals in the sphere of ambivalence. The sphere of ambivalence is the sphere of the animal. This is not to be derogatory of the animal, far from it. It is perfectly right and proper in that sphere. In the animal sphere, there is the realm of ambivalence. That is the proper realm of ambivalence, and therefore you have the ordinary love, hate, cruelty, kindness, and so forth at work. But out of man, I just mentioned these profounder aspects of the mind which are trying to emerge. Where man is concerned, something transcendent has to come out. Man alone knows what transcendence means, could mean, and the possibility of transcendence. So, love, goodness, truth, beauty, in that transcendent sense, is something quite unknown to us. We only know the sphere of ambivalence and the conflict, the confusion, the unnecessary sorrow, which is all involved in it. We could be free of all that. Now, I want to deal with two questions which have been put by two people. Would you discuss a comparison of yoga and psychotherapy? That is the yogi's self-knowledge the same thing as the psychotherapist's cure of personality problems? And here is quite a lengthy question with some explanatory remarks before the actual question. What is the present fascination of the West for yoga due to? Is it that the split in the West between body and mind is widening, and yoga, with its one root in the body and the other in the spirit, is seen as a possible uniting factor, that is, a way of experiencing the self? I'll read all that just a little later, if I may. Now, a comparison of yoga and psychotherapy. You cannot compare the two. Your psychotherapist takes a man as he is in the world. He sees that this man is in an ill state, suffering, ill-adjusted, unbalanced, and all the rest of it. And all this is seen from the standpoint of the world's values. The world's evaluations, criteria, judgments, and considerations of what is good and healthy and happy. All the world over, we look at an individual as an individual and overstress his separateness from the totality. We also take it for granted that the individual is some sort of permanent entity. And your psychotherapist deals with the person, brings him to some sort of right state, perfectly legitimate term, right state, from the world's point of view, and then recirculates this person into the world. The world as it is. But supposing I'm a psychotherapist and I have done that, what have I actually done? Now please, I am not speaking derogatorily. What the psychotherapist has done is to recirculate a worldling who is capable of dealing with the world which produces all the situations and conflicts and difficulties which make a person ill. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a point of tremendous importance. Do realize this. Man is the instrument or the intended instrument of transcendence, of the infinite, of the perfect, which is utterly beyond all intellectual knowledge, utterly beyond what science knows. Transcendence functions through you or me only when my awareness of the nature of existence has undergone complete transformation. That is the whole story of spiritual or religious progress and development and fulfillment. This utter transformation of your mode of awareness, your very consciousness itself. Your consciousness is the one thing that you cannot put upon a silver salver and present it and say, there's your consciousness. Do you know what consciousness is? I don't. It is a useful word to express that something functioning in the living organism, which is the focal point, the infinity, which is the utterly small, through which the infinity, which is the utterly large, transcendence, God, functions through you and comes to flower. This is your immortal destiny. These are not words, not just words. I have seen something of this. This is the concern of religion in the real sense. This is the concern of yoga. How then can I discuss a comparison of yoga and psychotherapy? The spheres in which they operate, their contexts, are quite different from each other. All worldly doctoring and healing remains confined within the sphere of worldliness. But the psychology and the therapy which issues out of religion in the real sense, not all the external postures of piety and so forth. That's all childish nonsense. As far as the transcendent depths are concerned, that which emerges out of the world of religion or yoga in the profound sense is the transcendent. This is what we have to be concerned with. Something utterly different from worldliness. Where does the difference come in? How does it operate? Not in terms of external techniques, but in terms of that metanoia that takes place within ourselves. We have to be converted, and to be converted does not mean to be convinced by another person's arguments, ideas, ideals, however wonderful they may be, but to undergo that extraordinary change within oneself by which one suddenly becomes aware. Of course, it is not this, it is that. But if you have truly seen, you will discover that the word that totally includes this. The distinction between the within and the without, the self and the not self, is out. Between the conscious and the unconscious. So, the psychotherapist's cure of personality problems lies in a context which is at least one dimension of being and consciousness short of that of the religious or the yogi. The yogi is not concerned with recirculating a worldling into the world. You and I know what the world is like. Look at it. Why look at the world outside? Look at this world, oneself. What is it like? Order, harmony, happiness, fulfillment, the true man, God, eternity, is all that there? No, not at all. The very fact that we are seeking is the sign that we haven't got it. You don't seek what you've got. I don't go about seeking for my nose or my hand. It is there. Part and parcel of the living me. I don't seek what is already there. So you see, it is something like that. Now, this fascination of the West for yoga due to one may also inquire what is the fascination of the East for yoga due to. Of course, in the case of the East, it is not a present fascination, it has been a fascination for a little while. Man is a restless creature. He just can't keep quiet. He's always fidgeting. He changes his fashions, not merely with his clothes, or with his cars or his houses, but with his culture, with his intellectual pursuits. These are fashions which come and go. And because There are fashions. People take to the thing for a while. They go about telling all their friends, "Oh, you know, I'm doing yoga now. Are you? Isn't it marvelous? Oh, do tell me all about it." We have to be very kind and allow at least some degree of intelligence for everybody. The fact that it is a fashion, an intellectual or a cultural fashion which one is concerned with, is only too evident in that person's whole behavior. We, all of us, obtrude ourselves upon our society and upon Mother Earth. How many of us are capable of just being like the flower is? When you and I are true humans, true yogis, we shall be like the perfect rose that blooms eternally in the desert where no one is present. But that rose will pour out its perfume in ecstasy, not caring, not knowing whether there is anyone to appreciate it or not, whether it is beautifying the desert or not. So now, there is another side to it. People suffer and they seek. Every one of us and all people in the world have also this something which seeks the worthwhile, the really worthwhile. And it may be that in the ripeness of circumstance, the time is here and now when yoga, which was supposed to be exclusive to the East, has come west just as well. Maybe that you will be able to add something to this. To, perhaps add is not a very good word. You will be able to infuse yoga in our day and age with a new spirit which will release a profounder integration out of each and every one of us. That's something which you can look forward to if you like. The question goes on, is it that the split in the West between body and mind is widening, and yoga with its one root in the body and the other in the spirit is seen as a possible uniting factor, that is, a way of experiencing the self? This is something which the answer to this will come in what I have to say with regard to another question, which will be the last one. It is the last one, actually, here. But I will only say this in this particular connection. Yoga does not have one root in the body and the other root in the spirit. You see, the way the question is formulated shows the dichotomy in body and spirit. There is only one total reality. We live in a universe, not in a multiverse. Now, what is the problem due to? The problem is due to this organism, this living creature, which Mother Earth has produced, a human being, it is due to the incapacity of this organism to be completely and totally aware of the oneness of the One. The oneness of the One Total Reality. The fact that this is a universe, and what that word universe implies. We are conscious we are conscious in atomistic terms, separate atoms. We are not conscious in the field sense, the continuous field in which all the apparently separate atoms exist. You see? That other aspect, the completely containing aspect, is what we are ignorant of. We may accept it intellectually, but that's quite useless. Just as an intellectual acceptance, I behave atomistically. That is to say, separatively. You against me. Or you and I work together, provided you and I approve of each other. Then we talk of living and letting live, instead of living by letting live. In which case there'd be the totality. So you see, it is not that there is a body and a mind and a spirit or anything like that. And that these things are all sort of put together and screwed up tight and proper, and the machine, it is hoped, will work satisfactorily. It is not like that. It is a living, organic whole. We haven't got enough sensitivity as to the nature of livingness and the nature of wholeness. This is why questions of this type come up. And then when we say that one root in the body and the other in the spirit is seen as a possible uniting factor, that is, a way of experiencing the self. No, not so much experiencing as being. Being in its living totality is the source of the becoming process also. This does not mean that there is any entity being which is changeless, permanent, and all the rest of it. We are in quite deep waters here, but we have to stretch our mental muscles. I think that in saying that, a good deal of what is here has been answered. But I'll nevertheless read what is written here. Yoga accords supremacy to the so-called rational elements in human nature. It appears to say we need to control the unconscious psyche and the body with the eye of consciousness, presumably the personal ego, wherein resides the will. I don't think we can put it that way. Yoga does not accord supremacy to the so-called rational elements in human nature. Yoga, derived from yuj, the root yuj, means to join not separate bits in order to make a larger bit, but to join in this sense, that your awareness of the oneness, of the multitudinous variety which makes up that oneness, flowers out. It is a freeing of one's own awareness from its limitations. This is yoga. This is the joining. It's not that two separate bits are joined, the two separate bits remain the two separate bits. If the variety weren't there, the whole universe would be a deadly dull thing. The variety is there. But we have to awaken consciously to the complete relationships between all the items that make up the variety. This is yoga. This is the joining. See? So, there is no supremacy accorded to any one thing. When you're wholly conscious like that, you yourself have become unselfed. You are truly unselfed. Christian mysticism has called this reducing oneself to one's own nothingness. But in that nothingness is the entire plenitude of all existence. If you accord supremacy and you start comparing, then you immediately perpetuate conflict. He is better than me, therefore I struggle in order to become like him. And all the rest of it. It's horrible. In the educational world today, we are trying to get rid of giving marks and having exams and so forth. What are we getting rid of? Comparison. You know, in ordinary life, John swears that his sweetheart is the most beautiful girl in the world, and Bill swears the same about his girl. And they are both swearing the whole truth, the incomparable truth. Now, see it that way. Again, the unconscious psyche and the body with the eye of consciousness, presumably the personal ego, wherein resides the will. No, I rather feel that this is a terminology which does not apply to the context of yoga and of religion in the real sense. It is a worldly context, intellectually and culturally. That is to say, a context in which there is conflict between particulars. In yoga, as in Buddhist meditation, one is exhorted to concentrate. It is rather unfortunate that through the centuries, this idea of exclusive concentration has come to be associated with meditation in the profound sense, and particularly with samadhi. All exclusive concentration, concentrating upon the one particular whatever it is not a way of realizing the universality of the universe. You cut off the rest from this. No. The true samadhi, the true communion, and this is where so many mystics of all the religions also have gone wrong, is not a communion with God, the nice chap upstairs there. And remember that that God is always created by me in my petty little image. It is not that at all. It is being so self-unobtrusive, so awake to the whole, that you are in natural communion with the totality that is, and which the intellect can never know. We all are in this state of communion in profound slumber. Every one of us is, but we cannot remember it. And we never will be able to remember it, because remembering is again bringing it to the realm, to the level of the particular which is separate from the rest. There are many, many illusions which we have regarding all these deep aspects. But the instrument for concentration is the ego. Yes, that is so. The unconscious knows no discipline. How then, having to use the ego, do we forget it? I think since the time is getting on, it's gone well beyond what I intended it to be, I will only say this. The unconscious, as modern Western psychology has shown, is extremely powerful. But do remember, this vast unconscious is also extremely trivial, shoddy stuff, worthless stuff, the bulk of it. It's a terrible statement to make, I know. But to me, that is the fact. Work out carefully how this vast ocean of unconsciousness collects. This was known in ancient India. You study the Yoga Upanishads carefully. What they call the vasanas, this enormous ocean of mental impressions which have sunk into the depths, the vasanas. But what are these mental impressions? You look at your own lives, you look at the lives of other human beings, see what happens every day. Impressions are made, and then we either repress them or forget them if we don't like them or try to forget them, and we try to remember consciously only what pleases us. Now this vast, almost cesspool of all these impressions, what worth is it? But there is another unconscious, which, as far as I'm aware, is not very clear, if at all clear, in Western psychology. I shall probably deal with that in the talk now. So we'll have a short rest for 10 minutes, take some fresh air, and then we'll be at it again.